One of my favourite episodes of Star Trek was when the crew of the Enterprise encountered a creature which, if you looked at it, you were completely destroyed. The traditional unknown crewman syndrome took effect, and some crew member who had never been seen before on the programme, and you knew after this episode would never be seen again, enters the lair of the creature, looks at it, and is disintegrated by the impact of simply gazing on it. The twist in the tale was that people could not cope with looking at the creature, not because it was so ugly and fearsome, but because it was in fact so beautiful. So beautiful that to look at it was more than the sorry human could bear. And the looker was simply overwhelmed by the beauty. To look on it had such an impact, they were literally never the same again. Whenever I conduct a wedding, I always ask at the rehearsal, what an unfortunate word, if the bride will be wearing a veil on the big day. And if she is, I indicate the moment in the service, just prior to the vows, when the veil will be pulled back and the groom will be reassured to see that he is indeed marrying the lovely Mildred and not being married off on the sly to her cross-eyed sister Senger, presently smiling under the veil. That used to happen back in days of yore, but it couldn't happen here. What you see is what you get. The naked eye meets the naked eye, nothing held back, no disguises, direct and vivid. There's an ancient tradition in the Bible that when Moses returned from his encounter with God on Mount Sinai, after he had received the Ten Commandments, he had to wear a veil to cover the brightness of his face. So shattering was the effect of his being in such close communion with God, a physical transformation that was the outward expression of the inner spirituality of his intense encounter with the reality of God. It was as if he had looked on the face of God, and that was an experience that changed him. Something similar to that lies behind the saga of the bizarre events called the Transfiguration, when the appearance of Jesus actually changes and his disciples experienced the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And we shouldn't underestimate the shockingness of that affirmation, the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Other world religions would find it an outrage that Christians would make such a claim of the Galilean prophet. Jews and Muslims alike have a real problem with this Christian conviction that the glory of God might be evident on the face of the carpenter. But Christians also have a problem, the problem of having the courage to look at Jesus and feel the touch of his presence on our lives. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard speaks of this when he illustrates the truth that it would, he argued, have been impossible for an individual face to face with Christ to crucify him, whereas it was easy for a crowd to do so. The anonymous crowd could avoid his eyes. The solitary individual standing before the Christ would be a totally different situation. The movie Ben-Hur illustrates this truth very well in two incidents. Early in the story, a Roman soldier is about to bully and brutalise a Jew. His whip is raised, his heart full of prejudice and violence. Then we see the soldier meet the eye of Jesus, open, steady, questioning. And the soldier lowers his arm and cannot go through with the violence. In another scene, it is Christ who is the victim of violence, and we see only Ben-Hur meeting the gaze of the whipped and violated Christ. A look of horror crosses Ben-Hur's face, shame and pity and love, all at once beautifully captured by the actor as we imagine him seeing the bruised and battered face of the Christ, looking into the eyes that even in extremis seem to reach into the depths of his soul. Some Christians do the contemplating of Christ better than others. In the Roman Catholic tradition, with its Many aids to devotion, facing up to the reality of Christ, is made more accessible by the pictures, the icons, the crucifixes that leave the devout believer in no doubt what Christ was all about. And many Catholics would and still spend long hours in intimate communion with Christ through quiet meditation and prayer. In our bare, spare Presbyterian churches, we would perhaps much rather talk about Christ than talk to him. We claim that we want to avoid any mawkish sentimentality that so readily slides into superstition, so we sidestep the intimate confrontation and take refuge in words. Words, doctrinal exactness, the word preached, rather than the word met face to face. That approach runs the risk of ending up with some great ideas about God and sound statements and creeds, but little of the trembling soul and the emotional engagement with the living Lord that would shake us up and inspire our love. If we insist on avoiding looking for the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, if we shelter behind the veils of doctrinal correctness and words, 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 the danger is distance, coldness, a religion that lacks passion. We may feel that devotion to the person of Christ is not our kind of discipline, not our kind of preoccupation. Those intense feelings are for others to feel, what the Bible calls the deep groanings of the Spirit within us, which is born of a love for Christ. Ours, an experience of the faith that is much more than intellectual commitment to the soundness of his vision for humanity. That rather than it is to do with him, who he was for us, the kind of love that grows when we spend time in contemplation and in stillness in his presence, quiet, prayerful meditation. Of course, that is a huge and demanding discipline. It's about being imaginative and courageous, reading about him, absorbing his truth, feeling our way into his teaching and his life, listening to his encounters with people, seeing how he related to them, considering what he wanted from his followers. When we read the Gospels and allow their truth to filter into our souls, we may wonder how on earth it ever got allowed to become dull and heavy and grim. For the gospel accounts and descriptions are vibrant and wonderful, and the Christ who meets us there demonstrates such courage and wisdom and strength. How we turned him into a tame Messiah is a mystery. Tame, he ain't. There is such drama and power there, and we're pulled into it when we allow ourselves to read the stories with the heart as well as the mind, to think the thoughts, feel the feelings. Perhaps it's up to the great artists of our time to salvage the power and the personality of Christ from the wreckage of centuries of dull preaching and poor presentation. You can't watch Zeffirelli's movie Jesus of Nazareth and not be impressed and moved. You cannot see the film Jesus of Montreal and not have your curiosity stirred. The enigma that is Christ presented there. Nor see a performance of Godspell and not wonder how we managed to lose the humour and the sheer joy of the man over all these centuries. Or watch Pasolini's Gospel according to St. Matthew and not smile as the children tug at the cloak of Christ, be reminded with a sharp shaft of light how he really did love the children and long for them to be welcomed by his church. We see these artistic expressions and appreciate afresh how human he was, how vulnerable he was, how brave. Exposure to these contemporary interpretations of the life of Christ refreshes our imagination and enlivens our response to him. And looking on him in word, in illustration, in movie, drama, poetry, music, those touch us and invite us to be changed into his likeness. As who he is, his personality begins to impress us and percolate into our character and thinking, and we know how he thinks, and we see the truth of what he says, we aspire to his nature, we begin to be changed into his likeness through the agonizingly slow process the Bible calls sanctification. The jargon word for the influence by which we are changed from self-centred, shallow, short-term, opportunistic moral compromisers, changed to men and women who espouse the way of Christ and want to live our lives with Him as our guide and example. And that won't happen by photosynthesis, by accident. We listen to Him, we think about who He was and what He did, we spend time in His presence, and in so doing, we will inevitably become people who begin to absorb His values, to love His truth, to reflect His goodness, to bend our wills to His purposes, to be filled with His Spirit. It's a two-way process. We stay close to Him and we lose our appetite for the old things that used to be so important to us. We will want less of the stuff that used to preoccupy us and used up our energies and our talents. And the second thing is that our appetite for His kind of world and His kind of priorities will be sharpened, and we will be hungry for the things of the kingdom of God. Our life will be like an old house being renovated, except that the rising up of the new building will not have to wait for the total destruction of the old, but the process will go on two fronts. As one person described it, like the airing of a house filled with noxious odours, as the old air is drawn out and the new makes its appearance. And the building blocks of that new set of attitudes and priority remain the Bible, the experience of worship and fellowship, time spent with Christ in reflection and meditation, letting His life flow into our life. As the hymn writer says, this makes sense for us. As we gaze on your kingly brightness, so our faces display your likeness, ever changing from glory to glory. Mirrored here, may our lives tell your story. Shine on me. Or as the lovely little chorus puts it, turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in His wonderful face. And the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace.